logically very rewarding, gets eroded and eroded. And then when a someone comes along who can appeal to that sense of tribal identity and say, well, we'll make our tribe great again, can stir up a lot of trouble. So what we really need to do is not, you know, deny that aspect of ourselves, that evolutionary background, but find ways of satisfying that sense of belonging, of group identity, that are pro-social, that work in favor of everyone rather than excluding or you know, demonizing and scapegoating.
Well, on that extremely complex, long thought, we're going to have to end it, Richard. Wish we could have gone on, but we're plumb out of time. So thank you so much, Richard Heinberg. Go to kboo.fm/Wednesday Talk Radio to look at some links and find out more. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Paul.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Books and Records! Books and Records! Come on down to KBOO's annual used book and record sale on Saturday, August 19th, noon to 6 p.m. at Cider Riot. There will be fabulous books, DVDs, CDs, and vinyl at ridiculously low prices. It's a fun community event that benefits your favorite community radio station. KBOO again. That's KBOO's annual used book and record sale on Saturday, August 19th from noon to 6 at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under community events.
It's 9:01. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Here's what we have coming up for you for the duration of the morning. First, on Political Perspectives, Walter Johnson describes a river of dark dreams, slavery and empire in the Cotton Kingdom. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And then at 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock, The Food Show talks to Dub Travis, owner of Dub's St. John's, about Support Black-Owned Restaurants Week 2017. Laura Shapiro's book, What She Ate, Six Remarkable Women and the Food That Tells Their Stories. And please remember that KBOO keeps you informed and involved, and we can only do that with your help. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. Thanks for tuning in this morning.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, today. River of Darkness, Slavery and Empire in the Cotton Kingdom, the title of a new book by Harvard University history professor Walter Johnson. We spend the hour with Professor Johnson. From the days of slavery to the start of the Civil War, he discusses the interrelationship between slavery and the building of empire on both sides of the Atlantic, the expansionist vision of the slaveholding class, the remaking of Mississippi from forested lands to cotton plantations, the centrality of slavery to capitalism and the global economy, jails for slaves, and the continuum with today's mass incarceration. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. The CEOs of athletic wear manufacturer Under Armour, computer chip maker Intel, and pharmaceutical company Merck resigned Monday from the White House's American Manufacturing Council, with a Merck withdrawal drawing a quick and angry Twitter outburst from President Trump. Merck CEO Kenneth Frazier cited the president's failure to explicitly rebuke the white nationalists who marched in Charlottesville, Virginia over the weekend. He wrote on Twitter Monday that, quote, America's leaders must honor our fundamental values by clearly rejecting expressions of hatred, bigotry, and group supremacy. Frazier is one of the few African Americans to head a Fortune 500 company. Under Armour CEO Kevin Plank resigned from the panel later Monday, saying his company will focus on promoting unity, diversity, and inclusion through sports. Intel CEO Brian Krzanich followed, writing that while he had urged leaders to condemn white supremacists and their ilk, many in Washington, quote, seem more concerned with attacking anyone who disagrees with them. Trump was under increasing pressure to call out the white supremacist groups involved in the Charlottesville demonstration. He lashed out almost immediately at Frazier, saying on Twitter that he will, quote, now have more time to lower ripoff drug prices. North Korean state media is reporting that leader Kim Jong-un reviewed his military plans to rain an enveloping fire around the U.S. territory of Guam, but opted not to fire missiles at this time. Despite the stand-down, some residents of Guam were alarmed after two radio stations aired an erroneous emergency alert today. The Korean Central News Agency reports that Kim visited the Korean People's Army as the self-imposed mid-August deadline for a missile demonstration approached. But after hearing the plan and considering it, Kim opted not to give the order to launch missiles, but instead, according to state media, would, quote, watch a little more the foolish and stupid conduct of the Yankees. Kim also warned that the U.S. should not test North Korea's restraint. On Guam, the territory's Homeland Security Office says two radio stations aired an unscheduled test of the emergency alert system shortly after midnight. The agency said the announcement that the system had issued a civil danger warning for Guam was due to an unauthorized test and was not connected to an emergency. Protesters in North Carolina toppled a nearly century-old statue of a Confederate soldier on Monday at a rally against racism. Activists in Durham brought a ladder up to the statue and used a rope to pull down the Confederate soldier's monument that was dedicated in 1924. A diverse crowd of dozens cheered as the statue of a soldier holding a rifle fell to the ground in front of an old courthouse building that now houses local government offices. The state of California and the city of San Francisco are suing the federal government over President Trump's restriction of public safety grants to so-called sanctuary cities, whose law enforcement agencies do not cooperate with federal immigration enforcement. And as KPFA's Justin Gold reports, the lawsuit makes California the first state to challenge the administration's sanctuary city policy.
San Francisco City Attorney Dennis Herrera says burdening local governments with enforcing federal immigration law will waste valuable defense resources, and that sanctuary cities are among some of the safest in the country.
Our police and deputies are focused on fighting crime, not breaking up hardworking families.
The lawsuit names U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions and seeks a court order to declare new requirements for the city to receive Edward Byrne Memorial Justice Assistance Grants unconstitutional. Under the criteria, local governments would be required to allow federal agents unlimited access to their detention centers and to provide the federal government 48 hours notice before releasing an individual it suspects of being in the country without authorization. While some say the requirements are modest, critics have pointed out that they could expose cities and municipalities to legal and financial liabilities. Others have charged that the federal government is already capable of enforcing immigration law on its own, and that these regulations are merely an attempt to get state and local governments to capitulate to the federal government's crusade to vilify immigrants. California Attorney General Javier Becerra says that great irony lies in the fact that the Trump administration's requirements would actually make cities and communities less safe.
We're intent on fighting crime. We're intent on gaining the resources that we need, and we're intent on stopping anyone who would try to deny us the dollars that we have earned.
For KPFA, Pacifica Radio News, I'm Justin Gold.
You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
That was our news headlines. And now we turn to Professor Walter Johnson on River of Darkness, Slavery and Empire in the Cotton Kingdom. All righty, so our guest is Walter Johnson, and he has a book, River of Dark Dreams, Slavery and Empire in the Cotton Kingdom. Now, Walter Johnson, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay. Now, you focus from the Louisiana Purchase to, I suppose, up to the Civil War. I wanted to talk a bit about the Louisiana Purchase made back in 1803, over 800,000 square miles for just $15 million. So that was a pittance.
Right.
And how that came about and the role of the Haitian Revolution.
It's long been argued, although I think in an undercurrent, that the Haitian Revolution was the precipitating cause of the Louisiana Purchase. And this is an argument that goes back to W.E.B. Du Bois in the closing of the slave trade. And or in the book is entitled Suppression of the African Slave Trade to the United States of America, published in 1899. It's Du Bois' doctoral dissertation. It's a fantastic book that everyone should read. But in any event, Du Bois, I think, in to my knowledge, is the first person to realize the significance of the Haitian Revolution in underwriting the Louisiana Purchase. France's New World Empire was centered in Haiti, and Haiti was, in, say, 1776, was the richest colony in the world. C.L.R. James writes about Haiti that on no other place on the face of the earth was so valuable per square inch as Haiti. But the Haitian Revolution takes Haiti out of the picture for France. And France's vision of a new world empire had included the Mississippi Valley as a food-producing subordinate colony to Haiti. The idea was that the Mississippi Valley would be the breadbasket that would allow Haitian slaves to survive, to grind out bitter lives without producing any food for themselves. That they would eat grain from the Mississippi Valley. And so the Haitian Revolution the Haitian Revolution makes the Mississippi Valley drastically less valuable to France, and that is, I think, the condition of possibility for the Louisiana Purchase.
Right, and also took away the fear of some collaboration between France and Spain, right, in defending that territory, perhaps coming together and defending that territory from the rest of the United States. But it's interesting. I'm glad you mentioned C.L.R. James and his book, Black Jacobins. C.L.R. James really talked about the Haitian Revolution as being a huge global event that was just, I think today, underestimated. A lot of people don't know about it. But I was interested also in your thesis about the global economy and globalization and the role that cotton and what went on in the Mississippi Valley had to do with global capital and global capitalism. You know what I mean? People think that
absolutely.
It's a new thing, this globalization, right?
Right. Well, no, it certainly, I think it dates, you know, that Haiti is the leading edge of the global economy of the 18th century.
Uh-huh.
And what I'm arguing is that the Mississippi Valley is the leading edge of the global economy of the 19th century. And once the Mississippi Valley and Alabama and Mississippi are formally incorporated into the United States through military action, which is to say United States military action against Native Americans, against Africans, against African Americans, and against whites allied with other European powers. Once that happens, that's really the beginning of the takeoff of the 19th century global economy. And that is an economy that is centered on cotton and land in the Mississippi Valley or in the Deep South, really. And that land boom and the cotton boom are directly related to the development of industrial capitalism in the northern United States, but more importantly, in the north of England. And so it is expropriated native lands and black labor that produces the cotton that is the raw material of industrial development, of the Industrial Revolution of the early 19th century.
Just before you go on, how does this contrast then with Thomas Jefferson's view in terms of the Louisiana Purchase and the vision that he professed?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that Jefferson went through, you know, several versions of how it was that the Mississippi Valley might be incorporated into the United States, but they were not aggressively commercial visions. They mm-hmm. were explicitly white supremacist visions, and so one of them centers on the notion of freeholding white yeomen, small farmers, independent, self-sufficient subsistence farmers who would be both provide a kind of a western border for the United States and would not be subject to what Jefferson saw as the corruptions of industrial capitalist life, wouldn't have to work for a wage. And so since they didn't work for a wage, they wouldn't be subject to a boss. A boss couldn't tell them how to vote. And they wouldn't get in debt. And so their creditors couldn't tell them how to vote. And so for Jefferson, I think the dominant vision that he has of the Mississippi Valley, and this is the vision that really in the first instance underwrites the project of the General Land Office to take all of this expropriated native land and sell it off to small farmers, envisions this as a kind of a small-holding, white yeoman farmer Arcadia.
Yeah.
And then, in the event, something quite different happens.
Right, and of course Jefferson, who really didn't want to deal with slavery. I read somewhere he had written a letter to somebody saying the whole thing actually gives him nightmares, right? He's just glad for somebody else to deal with it.
Yeah, well, that's another part of his vision. I think once there's a debate about whether or not slavery should be allowed in these new territories, part of his vision becomes that by allowing slavery to spread into the Mississippi Valley, it will be quote diffused, and that the black population will be spread out so far that it will eventually disappear. You know, again, in the event things turn out to be quite the opposite, that the cotton boom and the expansion of slavery into the Deep South leads to what historians call a second slavery, a re-intensification and expansion of the institution of slavery in the United States, which had, you know, in the 1780s been actually in decline.
Yeah.
But by the 1820s is booming.
Yeah. Our guest is Walter Johnson. He is the Winthrop Professor of History and Professor of African and African American Studies at Harvard University. And his latest book, River of Dark Dreams, Slavery and Empire in the Cotton Kingdom. We are discussing his book. Also, the Mississippi Valley, you talk a lot about the Mississippi Valley. And for our listeners to know that includes parts of Louisiana, Mississippi, Arkansas, Tennessee, and Missouri. So it's quite
right,
a large
absolutely. And really,
territory.
You know, all the way up to Minnesota. But I'm primarily concerned with the area below St. Louis, between St. Louis and New Orleans on the Mississippi River.
Right. Okay. So there you have an economy, cotton, land, slaves, and this slew of people, in addition to those enslaved, the speculators, the slave traders. You have the steamboat, which was a relatively new thing that also helped with that. People grabbing up land. I mean, what a crew. You know, I try to visualize, you know, these people,
no,
right?
It's, well, there's a genre literature in the 19th century describing, you know, steamboat journeys, and the point being that everybody in the world is on steamboats, and the odder the character, the more likely they are to be found on a steamboat, and so these boats are seen as, you know, microcosms of the West, of the kind of the rough-hewn boom times in the United States. And of course, you know, the phrase, I can't, I guess, talk about steamboats and say the phrase boom time without mentioning how frequently these boats explode. These are very, very dangerous boats. They're absolutely essential to the development of the society and economy of the Mississippi Valley, and they are emblematic of the character of that because they are tremendously speculative and very, very dangerous.
Yeah, and they were relatively new as well. Yeah,
they were new. The first steamboat journey on the what's called the Western Waters on the Ohio, the Missouri, the Mississippi is in 1812. And then the, I think, you know, maybe by 1817, there are, say, 17 boats on the Mississippi. And by 1825, there are 10 times that many. I mean,
wow.
it's really an exponential sort of explosion of the economy that occurs right in that sort of very small window.
That's quite a remarkable growth there.
It's close to $300 million of cotton every year. It's an enormous amount of money. You know, I think that the cotton crop every year is greater in value than the federal budget of the United States, if I remember correctly. It's a terrific, you know.
Yeah, and if you try, I wouldn't even attempt to translate that into today's dollars, $200
million. We'll have to wait for the economist to
figure that one out.
Right.
And just painting a picture for us then of that region, because New Orleans was central, right, in terms of this whole...
Everything goes through it,
mm-hmm.
right? The entire Mississippi Valley from Minnesota to Missouri to Memphis to Natchez and, you know, all of that produce goes through New Orleans. And so New Orleans is, in 1840, is the second largest port in the United States. And it is the fourth largest port in the entire world. And so it is, you know, this again is, this is the leading edge of the 19th century economy. And what the steamboat allows is for that trade system to become, to shrink. The trade system, because first of all, it allows goods to be shipped upriver. That in the 1810s or even into the 1820s, the dominant way of doing business on the Mississippi was simply to put goods from upriver onto a flatboat and let them float down with the current. And
mm-hmm.
to try to ship anything against the current was impossible. So people would literally ship flatboats down the Mississippi River and then sell the wood for scrap and walk home. You know, that was how the economy worked in the 18th and early 19th century. Well, the steamboat changes all that. The steamboat makes it economically profitable for certain people. You know, fewer and fewer people over time as the competition increases to ship goods upriver. And that leads to a tremendous economic development.
And there was also an interesting relationship with the steamboat and that whole culture of the steamboat and kind of counterculture of the steamboat, because some black people were involved in it and maybe perhaps, you know, working in it in some way or smuggling and escapees and then the color differentiations, because the whole one drop of blood thing meant you could have some pretty light-skinned black people that you couldn't really tell, right?
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the one of the things that I try to emphasize is that the steamboat is the technological and economic predicate for this massive expansion and intensification of slavery. But at the same time, it presents slaveholders with new sorts of problems, and presents enslaved people with new sorts of mobility and possibility. And so, one of the, it's really striking when you're reading a 19th century slave narrative, and somebody, and this would be Solomon Northup or John Parker, says, "I really wanted to be sold to New Orleans." anything will be sold to New Orleans. Why? I mean, in the 19th century, New Orleans among enslaved people in Virginia is seen as a place of slaughter, a place of death. But as enslaved people learned more about New Orleans, or as they got closer or heard from other people, they realized that that was a place that you could get on a steamboat, whether you snuck on or actually hired yourself on, pretending to be free, or whether you were in fact employed on a steamboat as an enslaved person. There are, you know, hundreds, probably thousands of enslaved people who make their way out of slavery on steamboats. And then the other thing you mentioned is equally fascinating, because there are, you know, really, really fascinating 19th century court cases about the things that happen on steamboats. And one of the things that happens on steamboats, while these people, the way that some of these people escape is by passing for white. And, you know, there are enough court cases documenting this that it is significant in its own right. But one of the things that I argue is that the stories of these people who pass for white on steamboats make steamboat passengers, they're well enough known that steamboat passengers start to look at one another suspiciously. And to wonder, you know, well, that guy, you know, do you think he's Portuguese? Is he Cuban? You know, what's the story? And that I think is it's not the end of slavery, and it's not the end of white supremacy, but it is an interesting eddy of doubt right in the heart of the expansion of those systems.
Right, and another example of people creatively, you know, finding a way to get out of a bad situation.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Into a situation that was bad, but not as bad as the one before. So here you have with the great Mississippi going down then into the Atlantic Ocean. New Orleans also had one of the largest slave markets, didn't it?
Yeah, New Orleans is the largest slave market in North America.
Right, right. So New Orleans then very much the center of what you describe as an international trading system, because 90% of the cotton, as you say, ended up in Britain. So,
So one of the things that I am interested in and have tried to track the history of is of the transformation, expansion, and forced migration of slavery within the United States. So really through the interstate slave trade. People sold from places like Maryland and Virginia down to Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. Something, you know, around two-thirds of a million people between 1820 to 1860. So really one of the largest forced migrations in human history. All of those sales are, while they occur within the United States, are related to the working of the global economy. They're related to, you know, these are people who, by and large, are being moved from declining areas of tobacco production to emerging areas of cotton production. And one of the things that historians long ago did was that they graphed out the historical profile of cotton prices, and they graphed out the historical profile of slave prices. And those two graphs fit hand in glove on top of one another. You know, and so the price of slaves tracks the price of cotton throughout the antebellum period. And the price of cotton is set in Liverpool. You know, 85-90% of the cotton produced in the United States is shipped to Liverpool.
So one determined the other, definitely the interrelationship.
Right.
I want to get kind of down and dirty into this, because you talked about the migration, the largest migration of this million slaves, you know, down deeper, you know, into the South. I also want to just remind our listeners that our guest is Walter Johnson, Winthrop Professor of History and Professor of African and African American Studies at Harvard University. His book, River of Darkness, Slavery and Empire in the Cotton Kingdom. Fascinating, really, focusing in on global capitalism and early U.S. imperialism in the North and South America, as the book in part is described. Now, in terms of that migration, I wanted you to describe a little bit about the speculators. I mean the small guys, the ones who went and maybe bought, let's say in Virginia or somewhere like that, maybe 5 or 10 slaves, let's say, and then chained them, right? And did this march to deeper into the South, where you're going to get a better price.
Yeah, that's, I mean, there is a well-known price differential from really the 1820s on to between Virginia and Louisiana and Mississippi. And this is a fact which begins to infuse every facet of slavery on both ends of that trade. Slaveholders in Virginia by the 1850s are openly referring to themselves as slave farmers. They're openly saying, well, our export crop is human beings.
Mm.
And they're openly referring to enslaved women as breeders. And yeah, a lot of this trade is overland. It is people who walk or are, you know, every once in a while somebody will get sick and they'll be put in a cart, but they walk 20 miles a day from, say, Fayetteville, North Carolina to Clinton, Louisiana, overland.
Yeah.
The other branch of the trade is maritime. It's around the East Coast on boats from places like Tidewater, Virginia, to places like New Orleans. And all told, you know, as I said, we're talking about well over, close to 250,000 people, maybe more than that.
Yeah, so this...
In 40 years.
Yeah, this buying, transporting, selling of slaves. And then you also describe in your book this this thing about kind of jails, not really jails, but holding pens in a way for slaves that could hold up to 100 at a time and had showrooms and
yeah.
all this kind of
no,
thing.
No, this is, if you were to, you know, there's a document from New Orleans, I think it's in either 1852 or 1854, I can't remember right now, called the Census of Merchants. And they walked around the different neighborhoods of New Orleans, cataloging for the purpose of doing a new set of taxes. What are the various businesses? Well, there's a couple of neighborhoods in New Orleans where, you know, there is a very, very dense concentration of slave pens, is what they were called. And there, you know, there are anywhere from, you know, 10 to 100, 150 people for sale in each of these establishments at a time. There's, I think at the peak of the trade, there, you know, around 20 of them in the city of New Orleans. And people from downriver, in the sugar-producing parishes of Louisiana and from upriver and the cotton-producing areas, sometimes all the way up to Arkansas, would come to New Orleans to buy slaves. Now, there were also a number of smaller, you know, markets all over the Deep South. And, you know, Natchez is a fairly famous one at the forks of the road that there's been an effort to commemorate over the last decade or so. But, you know, really, any town with a courthouse, there were slave sales and legal, estate sales and debt sales, so state-ordered sales, as well as retail sales, which are really what I'm talking about with the professional slave traders.
Yeah, and they had a way of grading the slaves as well, right, in terms of the women and the men, and people could come and examine you and all that.
Yeah, so there are a set of market categories that people use to set standard prices. You know, prime men, number one men, number two men, middling men, same categories for women. And these have to do with age and supposed vitality and skill. And some of those characteristics, vitality and skill, are somatically marked. They're attributed to people by and large on the basis of their skin color, whether they are dark or light or copper colored or coffee colored, or, you know, there's a million words that pop up in the slave market, in the paper ephemera of the slave market to describe people. That people are put on sale and they are generally turned out for sale. somewhat surprisingly to me when I first saw this and saw documents that supported it, they turned out to sail wearing, you know, often wearing full black suits, and women in long skirts and long sleeves and headscarves. And, you know, which was puzzling to me because I thought about the slave market as a place of degradation, which of course it was. But the first step in commodification is to try to make everybody look not like Henry Bibb from Missouri or Solomon Northup from New York or William Wells Brown, again, from Missouri, but like a slave, you know, slave number 7.
Yeah.
So to have them sort of presented as identical. Well, then the buyers come in and they don't want to just buy a slave. They want to believe that they are buying the best slave. And
yeah.
that kind of dynamic between the uniformity that the sellers are trying to present and the specificity that the buyers are trying to pursue produces all kinds of conversations and inspections. People are asked to strip off their clothes, to show their scars, to talk about their skills, to talk about their pasts. And, you know, it is a gut-wrenching set of images.
Yeah.
It also, again, turns out to be that at the very inner workings of this economy, in the very interstices of all of this domination and subordination and exploitation, there's possibilities for enslaved people to resist. And so you see, if you read 19th century slave narratives, the narrative of John Parker, which has recently been republished under the title His Promised Land, is fantastic on this, because Parker describes sitting in the slave market and evaluating the buyers and then presenting himself according to his estimation of the buyers, of who might, you know, for instance, who might live in New Orleans. Well, if somebody lives in New Orleans, then that might make it possible for him to get on a steamboat and get, as he eventually does, to Ohio. So there's this
calculations on both sides.
There are calculations on both sides.
Yeah.
You know, and one wouldn't want to, you know, you don't say, well, it's insignificant that there's an internal slave trade and there's almost 1 million people sold because John Parker escapes, but nor can you tell the story, it seems to me, of that horrible forced migration without telling the story of John Parker. It seems
and of resistance. Resistance and the fact that the slaves were perfectly capable of plotting and planning and resisting when that possibility was there. But also with these connected to the markets then would be the pricing, because there was a lot of information, right, in terms of determining pricing, because you've got like Maryland going all the way down to New Orleans, and pricing being, I imagine, varied, but also being set. I mean, how did that work? I mean, people can send a fax or an email, right?
Right. Well, yeah. There's a lot of information going back and forth between the Deep South and the Upper South about what sorts of prices are being paid for slaves in New Orleans, and then that shapes what sorts of prices Upper South slaveholders are willing to pay. So, in one way, that these letters that go back and forth are the first step in the commodification of people, in the process by which people are turned into products, because they can't send back and forth letters which contain all descriptions of the infinite variety of human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's these letters that go back and forth which depend upon these categories, prime, number one, number two, and so which produce the sort of imaginary idea that such a thing as a number one man exists and that people can be put into these categories. And it's that trick of imagination, commodification, upon which the slave trade depends and functions.
And I want to talk a bit about cotton. Our guest is Walter Johnson, author of this book, River of Dark Dreams, Slavery and Empire in the Cotton Kingdom. And he is the Winthrop Professor of History and Professor of African and African American Studies at Harvard University. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And this is a one-hour special. You know, Walter Johnson, there is so little is known about all of this. So little is known about the trade and the kind of detail that you go into, which is why I so very much appreciate this work. And as you know, the whole spectrum of what happened in this country, slavery and the slave trade and the building of global capitalism is very much underrated. And until I believe we really learn more about all of this, to confront it and to take the power relations as a result of this and the price people are paying for it, it's going to be very, very difficult for us to have any honest and serious conversation, not only conversation about race, but also even about basic economics and divisions in this country and in other parts of the world. Having said that, I want to ask you mm-hmm. about cotton, right? In the land of cotton, right? There's songs about it. And, you know, my history comes from the Caribbean, you know, from Barbados. I was mentioning that to you, earlier. A slightly different, although brutal, experience there. So tell us a bit about cotton. What was involved in the cultivation and the harvest of, because it's really difficult. And
it is very, it's brutal. Very difficult. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that has struck me as I've thought about the Mississippi Valley is the way that the instrumentalization of human beings and the instrumentalization of nature go hand in hand in the history of cotton. And so in the 1820s, some planters in a place called Rodney, Mississippi, develop a hybrid strain of cotton, which has various names, but basically goes by the name Petit Gulf or Petit Gulf cotton. And the thing that makes that strain of cotton so popular is its, quote, pickability. That the cotton fiber, the boll, the sharp spikes around the cotton fiber, which is what the boll is, that opens up very wide, and the soft fibers inside are easily detached. And so, in a sense, what this hybrid strain of cotton is it's a plant that is engineered to the specifications of the human hand. Well, when we were talking about the slave market, really what slave buyers in the Mississippi Valley are interested in is human beings who are engineered to the specifications of the cotton crop. So what I'm trying to argue in part of the book is to think about the particular form that 19th century racism takes and relate it to the particular form of the economy. Now, enslaved people spend the majority of their waking lives in the Mississippi Valley cultivating cotton. Most people do. And that is backbreaking work. It is, you know, people are stooped over all day. They are working end-to-end across a field in what anyone who has been to Louisiana or Mississippi know is under intolerable white grinding sun that with combined with the humidity makes it, you know, difficult just to walk down the street. And then working sun up to sun down, as the saying goes, and then maybe taking a hour break in the middle of a day. Women would be able to nurse their children maybe once or twice in a day. There's descriptions of enslaved women working in fields with milk running out of their breasts. And so it's a situation in which I think that one of the things that I try to think about is that at some point in slavery, work and torture become indistinguishable. So we think about the bullwhip as the instrument of torture, and it certainly is. And then work itself is used as a punishment. People are forced to work brutal speed up, to run throughout the day to work, and really just the idea of working caked in dust, the cotton bowls, you know, cut up people's fingers. It is, I think, and I think this comes through the 19th century descriptions from ex-slave narrators, it is a form of torture.
It's difficult, I would have to say, you know, just thinking of what people went through, and I imagine for you just researching and reading this stuff. But the Mississippi Valley looked quite different when Native American people were there. I mean, there were forests, for example.
Right.
There weren't just these huge fields, right?
That's right.
Cotton fields, and that was part of what the slave labor had to do, right? Get rid of forests?
I mean, the first generation of enslaved people, you know, basically they cut down trees, or sometimes what they do is they girdle trees. They put a band of iron very tightly around the tree to kill the circulation through the tree, and then they, you know, then the tree falls down, and they often leave the stumps. I mean, there's descriptions of these fields planted in cotton that are full of stumps that nobody's taken time to pull the stumps out because they're so desperate to develop the economy. But really, when you today, if you get in an airplane and you fly over the middle part of the United States, you fly over the Mississippi Valley, then you can still see on the land the square pattern of the land office survey of the 19th century, the pattern by which native lands were expropriated, commodified, and sold off to the highest bidder. And the reason that you can see that pattern on the land, rather than simply seeing a whole bunch of trees, the reason that the stands of trees seem like interruptions in that landscape, rather than just the way that the landscape is because they were cleared by enslaved people. And so, you know, it's a very, once you recognize what it is that you're looking at, when you look out the window of a plane, it's very present. It's a very, very stark reminder of the history of the United States of America as a whole. One of the things that I want us to think about is that the history of slavery didn't just happen in Mississippi. The history of slavery also happened in Massachusetts. Right, that the mills in Lowell are spinning cotton that's harvested by enslaved people in Mississippi, and I think that it's important for us to keep in mind the connections between industrial development and financial services and mercantile capital in the 19th century, you know, throughout the United States to the system of slavery.
Yeah, and also reaching across the pond, as they say, of the Atlantic, because the cotton that was being sold to Britain and in mills in Manchester or wherever else, I mean, is also connected here.
No, mostly in Manchester, you're absolutely right that 85% of the cotton that is finished in Manchester originated in the United States. So earlier I said that 85 to 95% of the cotton produced in the United States goes to the north of England. And correspondingly, 85% of the cotton processed in the north of England comes from the United States. And so these two poles, Mississippi and Manchester, Liverpool and Louisiana, are inextricably linked in the global capitalism of the 19th century. And I think one of the, you know, you started off the segment talking more generally about capitalism and globalization. And I think one of the things that has become important to me, one of the things that I've learned over the time of the too long a time of working on this book is to stop trying to think about slavery and capitalism as separate things. And the story that we've been told is the story that that capitalism triumphs over slavery, that somehow the history of freedom is linked to the history of capitalism. And this is, you know, this is in some sense the founding mythology of capitalism in the United States, and I think really in the Atlantic world generally. Well, that's not true. You know, capitalism and slavery come into the world together. They are one thing, and that is certainly the case. There was no 19th century history of capitalism without slavery. The history of capitalism in Great Britain, or the history of capitalism in New York or in Baltimore or in Boston, was the history of slavery. They're one thing, not two.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and things are going very well for in the Mississippi Valley. A lot of money is being made, and you have just said slavery central to capitalism. You talk about the slaveocracy more integrated in the global economy than people generally realize. And sometimes I think that also what you just said might be the reason that in the United States, there is so little discussion, you know, about slavery and what happened and the details of what went into it and the money that was made, because then one would have to face it, wouldn't one?
In the United States, too often, the history of slavery gets told as the prehistory of freedom. And instead, I think that there are other ways. You know, that's not to say that the you know, moment of emancipation isn't a revolutionary and world-making moment, but I think that there are other ways that we need to think about the persistence of slavery in the history of the United States.
Absolutely.
One of the most obvious ways is thinking through the persistence of the wealth and privilege, white privilege, created by enslaved people in very, very material terms, right? Well, you know, what are the firms that exist today, or you know, the way that I was talking about the landscape of the Mississippi Valley? But there are, you know, we could talk about the fact that there's an exception right in the heart of the 13th Amendment, the amendment that abolished slavery, is an exception. And that exception is people who are imprisoned are not covered by the protections of the 13th Amendment. Well, that's actually, I mean, maybe this is something that is generally known, but
no, it's not.
The most extraordinary fact that you have this unbelievable rate of black male incarceration in the United States,
mm-hmm.
and those people who are incarcerated are not covered, explicitly not covered by the amendment to the Constitution which abolished slavery. So, you know,
unbelievable.
It doesn't take a real leap of logic to say, well, so they can still be slaves? Are they slaves? You know, how do we think about that? So there are a lot of ways that I think it is important to try to think about the historical and material presence of slavery in our lives
today. Right, and the price we're paying today. And we discuss mass incarceration quite a bit, you know, on our show, and
sure.
including the fact that there are more black men incarcerated today than, I can't remember the exact year, in the 1800s of those who were
right.
who were enslaved.
Right.
It's just outrageous. But also, just on the history part of this now, things are going very well. The slave trade, cotton, a lot of money is being made in the United States, North and South, internationally, on this. And, you know, there is the specter and the fear of the Haitian Revolution and, you know, the kind of black fear, I think they called it in Cuba and other places after that,
right.
that revolution of slaveholders knowing that you have a population of people who are greatly oppressed and at any moment could rise up. And that happened in New Orleans back in 1811,
right.
you know, for example. And, you know, there were some examples of pretty rebellious slaves. So there's that fear, and also the abolitionist discussion going on. So in your book, you talk then about how in the Mississippi Valley, of interest in expanding outside of the United States to places like Cuba and the story of this guy who actually invaded Nicaragua.
Mm-hmm. William Walker.
William Walker, right. Yeah.
He became the sort of the self-appointed president of Nicaragua.
Yeah. So they had a global view also of expansion of slavery.
They absolutely did. And they I think, you know, there's two parts to that global view. And one we've talked about a fair amount, which is that they really believe that they are on the leading edge of history, that slavery is proving itself out as the motor of the global economy. But I think that you really importantly brought us back to the beginning of the conversation and the Haitian Revolution, because all of that boosterism and excitement is edged with fear.
Mm-hmm.
And at the most basic level, that is a fear of black capability. Because slaveholders don't do anything for themselves. Right, I mean, that's what it is to be a slaveholder, is to have somebody else do everything for you. And so slaveholders in their daily lives depend upon the intelligence and physical capacity of enslaved people to survive. So you know, they know that these people aren't stupid. They know that these people aren't weak, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that I think starts to come through is their fear of their slaves, their fear of their slaves' capacity to, to cooperate with one another, and to take all of that energy and strength and intelligence that is apparent from the fact that this society actually works through the stolen talents of enslaved people, and what would happen if they turned that against white people, as they do periodically throughout the history of the Western Hemisphere and the United States. And so this whole story is edged with fear. And that fear becomes, in the 1850s, particularly acute around the question of Cuba, because there is a fear that the Spanish Empire in Cuba is so weak that the British will come in and take over Cuba, and the British, by the 1850s, have long since abolished slavery and have become the greatest, as well as the greatest cotton-consuming country in the world, the greatest abolition-promoting country in the world. So there's a fascinating contradiction,
mm-hmm,
right at the heart of British history. This is what Eric Williams' amazing 1944 book, Capitalism and Slavery, is about. But the defenders of slavery, or the advocates of slavery in the United States, are absolutely paranoid about the idea of British people taking over, the British taking over Cuba. And so they decide, and some of them in the Deep South decide in 1849 and then in 1851 to mount illegal, independent paramilitary invasions of Cuba to try to take it over and make it part of the United States. And that's the same sort of effort mounted by William Walker in 1856 in Nicaragua. Now, Nicaragua is particularly interesting to the advocates of slavery because there is a way in Nicaragua, particularly before the Panama Canal, to get between the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean. And so they believe that if they, you know, they control Nicaragua, they really control the hinge of the global economy. And
wow,
they'll be able to connect the Mississippi Valley economy that we've been talking about to the, you know, to the Pacific, to California and to China. And they really, you know, they really do have a map for global domination.
Right, and having slaves in all of those areas. Well, Walter Johnson, I just looked at the clock and realized this has gone so quickly, and I've only talked with you about half of what I wanted to discuss, so we're going to need to have you back.
Oh, that'll be fun.
Yeah.
It's been a great conversation, and I really appreciate you having me on.
Thank you so very much, Walter Johnson.
Okay.
We're out of time. I'd like to thank Professor Johnson. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow morning. But if you would like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Please like and friend us on Facebook if you are a member of Facebook, and check out our website at sotrueradio.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
Hey, on Friday, August 18th, Portland Resistance will be holding a peaceful rally and march in solidarity with the community of Charlottesville, Virginia. Friday's action is important. This situation is serious, really serious. So Friday, August 18th at 5:30 p.m. That's Friday, August 18th at 5:30 p.m. The Salmon Street Fountain by the river. It's time to show up.
Yeah, it's 10 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming right up, it's Air Cascadia Headlines, Interviews, and Commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, stay tuned for Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And then we have the Food Show at 11, today talking to Dub Travis, owner of Dub's St. John's, about Support Black-Owned Restaurants Week 2017, plus Laura Shapiro's book, What She Ate, Six Remarkable Women and the Food That Tells Their Stories. Okay, stay tuned for Chris. She's coming right up.